big picture frameworks and strategies. This is not going to be so directly clinical as what I talked about before, but I thought it was important to give you a bit of an overview of where palliative medicine as a specialty has come from and what the drivers have been for some of the developments that we're seeing now. Palliative medicine as a specialty hasn't really existed for very long. I think it was 1988 that it was recognised by the Royal College of Physicians. But although there have been, I think, 8 national strategies for paediatrics since the birth of the NHS, there wasn't a national strategy for palliative care till 2008, I think it was. The first mention that really palliative care as a priority got nationally was in the National Cancer Plan, the year 2000, where it was stated clearly that the care of all dying patients must be improved to the level of the best. But bear in mind that was the cancer plan, so only oncologists got to read it. Followed by that, the sort of first glimmers of acknowledgement, was the End of Life Initiative in the year 2003. And this is the year of Nigel Crisp, who actually had some really helpful things to say. And one of the things was that better care of the dying should become a touchstone for success in modernising the NHS. Bear in mind Tony Blair and modernisation and all that. But it was this idea that the dying are significant, we need to care better, and that may be a measure of how successful our health services. And there were 3 things around at the time. All had been developed independently that were sort of drawn together as being things that the NHS ought to think about. One was the Gold Standards Framework, which I touched on, for primary care. Then the Liverpool Care Pathway, which actually was devised in a hospital, not in a hospice, for people regardless of diagnosis, so for everyone. And then Preferred Priorities of Care, which was the forerunner of the current advanced care planning that we've got. Then came the next stage review. This was Lord Darzi. And do you remember he had 8 areas for improvement in the NHS? And number 8 was end-of-life care. So we got a look in there. And then in order to develop that, along came the first ever national end-of-life strategy. And there were 2 real drivers for that. To bring about a step change in access to high-quality care for people approaching the end of life, very much about quality, and really driven by the acknowledgement that many people did not die as they would have wished. And I gave you quotes to support that in my last talk. And again, this really was a major driver, the huge discrepancy between where people said they would like to die and where they actually died. As this field is only about, the strategy is relatively new, they've very much had a mind to the demographics of how it will go ahead in years to come. And it is true that the number of deaths per year is rising significantly. There'll be nearly 600,000 a year by 2030. The number of elderly is getting much bigger, particularly the very elderly. Most of them will be elderly with poor health, an increase in chronic illness and frailty, and a significant increase in single-person households. And all that will mean, in terms of informal carers and people's preferred place of care, the great mantra is that care must be in the community. That's where people want to be. But what we're finding, if you ask people on the street where they want to die, they say, at home, of course, at home. If you ask people in hospital who are dying, who may have already had one bad experience of community care letting them down, they don't want to go back home to be on their own with a carer possibly popping in 3 times a day at a time they cannot predict. Care in the community for them looks a lot less attractive. The reason I put this up is because really it highlights that it's only since 2008 that there has been a kind of national recognition of the role of the acute hospital in the care of the dying. It is very, very new in acute hospital culture, and that may well be why there have been big problems with things like the Liverpool Care Pathway. Dying in hospital is countercultural to the institution and to the, many, many of the individuals that work there. So, what did the National End of Life Strategy say? It said it is a whole systems approach. Right, first of all, you need to change the culture and attitudes by having a dying awareness campaign. Let's get everybody talking about dying. I'll tell you about it in a minute. Raise the profile of end-of-life care. Yep, we're all for that. Care pathway approach. Now, that's gone down like a lead balloon, hasn't it? But that was the idea, that you had standardised ways of treating people so that you got high standards and you got consistency. These were not meant to be tracks that people went down and never came off. It was a way of ensuring that in the simplest but most effective way, there was standardisation. Individualised care about needs and choices, obviously, advanced care planning. The highest quality services, regardless of diagnosis or place of care. And I think this is probably the most significant of the initial aims. There has been, and there still is actually, huge inequality in this country regards the provision of end-of-life care. For many, many years, a few fortunate people, usually with cancer, got care in hospices. And then for the rest, there was virtually nothing. If you were fortunate, you got linked in with a hospice community service. But if you look at the figures, the number of people benefiting was tiny. You had huge numbers of what were called the disadvantaged dying, who had non-cancer, were often living alone, ethnic minorities, all kinds of groups in society who didn't wish to or couldn't access these very high standard hospice services that actually only served a few. And then if you're going to make good end of life care work, you have to have coordination across care settings, because we all know the very sick move. They move from community to hospital to rehab to nursing home to hospital. They're constantly changing where they are. So it's got to be set up so you can keep track of them and make sure everyone's talking to everyone else. And finally, not forgetting the role of the carer, supporting carers and following that care into bereavement. So that was the plan. And each, they sort of strategize that into these six steps. Starting to talk, assessing and planning, coordinating care, delivering the care, terminal care, which is step five, and then care after death. And they made suggestions as to what should happen and what tools you could use at each step of that. That's quite a complicated slide, but it's in the National End of Life Care Strategy document, and it's on the internet in lots of places if you want to look at it in more detail. And then underpinning all these steps, spiritual care services, support for carers and families, and information. And there have been separate strands of work in all those areas as part of the National End of Life Care Strategy. So it relied very heavily on these three enablers again, and really made them the gold standard for care. It said, if you want to be doing these are the tools you should be using. And really the drive for community care was, it's what people want, but it was also, if we're honest, it's cheaper. Now that's debatable, actually, if you're going to do it properly, but this has very much gone into management psychology, this assumption that it's actually what's best for everybody. And I think if we're going to do individualised care properly, we need to be prepared to question that for some people. Now, the gold standards framework, I just look at this in a little bit of detail because it's been so influential. Are you all familiar with it? Is this a new thing? It was devised and initially implemented within the National Health Service. It has gone private. It is now a tool that you buy. They've set themselves up as a kind of independent company, and you buy into it now, which I think is a little bit unfortunate. And people are finding other ways of delivering the same kind of education and priorities apart from the gold standards framework. But it really set five goals for general practices, not really to care in a slightly different way, but without increasing their workload. It was really about organisation and efficiency, not actually having to do more. And it gave guidelines about symptoms, preferred place of care, trying to avert crises, particularly averting hospital admissions and trying to keep people at home if that's what they wanted, supporting the carers and teamwork. So those were its goals. And it went through the identify, assess, plan framework with lots and lots of emphasis on communication, which is basically a very good way of delivering any kind of healthcare, isn't it? That's the way to do it, really. What that meant in practice was end-of-life registers. The idea was that every general practice should have a register of people thought to be near the end of life, and then there would be a meeting once a month, and those patients were discussed. So they were constantly at the forefront of people's thinking. They could be flagged up to the out-of-hours services. Often district nurses, modern matrons, palliative care nurses would come to those meetings to report, to hear, just to formulate a kind of information exchange and keep these people on the radar. It also would update about advanced care planning, and it's taught people to do that. Message in a bottle is an interesting little device. Do you know about this? It's been devised, I think, by the Lions Club, a charitable thing. I should have brought one along. It's a little plastic tub about this big with green writing on it, and there is a sticker inside it. You take the sticker off and you stick it to the hall window or to the front door, and it says message in a bottle in the fridge. And then inside the little pot, there's just a small piece of paper with that patient's wishes on it, their advanced care plan, and any other special information, like do not resuscitate me, do not take me to hospital. And so if there's a crisis and the ambulance comes, they see the little sticker, they look in the fridge, and it just gives them an idea that if this patient's collapsed, you know, perhaps they think twice before whizzing them off in an ambulance. So that's quite useful. And then just in case prescribing as well, it gives it's given a lot of training and support to having drugs in the house that people can access. Huge emphasis on education, and particularly aimed at district nurses who, if we're honest, do the vast bulk of care for dying patients in the community. Nursing homes is a very interesting one. Most admissions of dying people, where the person then goes on to die within 72 hours, are from nursing homes. And there's a huge need to support nursing homes in preventing that kind of admission. But the work there is very difficult. Huge turnover of staff, many of whom don't have English as their first language. So and it's such a big sector as well. Alongside the gold standards framework, there have been other initiatives from some of the charities. The most successful has been the Marie Curie Delivering Choice programme, which has worked with 18 sites across the country. And what it does, again, it's about efficiency of working, joining up services, trying to make it seamless with as little kind of expense and intervention as possible. What they've tended to do in some places is set up 24-hour coordination services, but really it depends on what the area needs. One area realised that what it really needed to do end-of-life care well was a dedicated ambulance. So Marie Curie funded one, and now they find that actually they can get people into the hospice rather than to the hospital simply because they've got their own ambulance to take them there. So just little things. They look very much at the individual scenarios and say, what do you need to make this work better? But it's not easy, and the community, as I'm sure you're aware, is fraught and probably about to become more fraught with the changes that are about to come upon us. There are multiple agencies. There is often complex politics, the interplay between the private sector, which lots of nursing homes are in the private sector, charitable sector, which includes the hospices, and the NHS, 24-hour nursing and domestic care agencies are now private, and quite commonly, in our experience, will refuse to care for particular people because they don't feel skilled enough to deliver that kind of care. Things like running a syringe driver, say, or having a syringe driver in the house. Getting 24-hour support 7 days a week in the community is a big luxury for lots of areas, and what there is very thinly spread. And access to controlled drugs is very difficult as well. The situation with community pharmacists has been fraught for years. Simply nobody will fund a contract that pays pharmacists to be around to prescribe drugs out of hours. Some do it out of the goodness of their hearts, but again, it can mean the difference between somebody staying at home and being comfortable and actually being admitted to hospital because it's the only way they can get the drugs. So, National End of Life Strategy 2008, and as sure as nice night follows day, along comes NICE guidance. You don't have to be around very long, and it pops NICE. And we had our own NICE guidance for end-of-life care in 2011. And what's happened, they've taken the end-of-life strategy and the NICE guidance and sort of looked at where end-of-life care is, and they've come up with the National End-of-Life Care Programme as a way of kind of implementing both those things together. And it wasn't a bad time, actually, 2011, just to see where things were at and how they needed to be tweaked. But it also acknowledged that things had been moving quite quickly and quite a few new things had popped onto the scene, which I'll talk about. Here we go. These are all things that have popped up as part of the National End-of-Life Care Programme. This one, Involve Me, is a big forum for looking at end-of-life care and decision-making in people with dementia and learning difficulties, because clearly there are considerably different resources and skills needed for those groups. And there is a lovely advanced care planning document for people with dementia called This Is Me, which is quite useful. The National End-of-Life Care Intelligence Network is an amazing website that has got all the statistics you could possibly ever wish to know about end-of-life care in this country. Loads of stuff. And they keep that fairly up-to-date. E-learning. The way we're all meant to learn all this, well, most of medicine nowadays, is by e-learning, which is great if you're of that persuasion. there is a huge amount in the National End-of-Life Strategy around e-learning. There are something like hundreds of modules now on every possible aspect. The difficulty is that most people can only access this through the NHS, and the people that need it are in places like nursing homes. And the system to get them onto into the software has been quite tricky. And then we've got ELQA, which is a quality assessment tool, which was for individual services to kind of benchmark themselves. But not many people are doing that. And as you don't actually have to share your data, you can go on it anonymously, it's not terribly useful at the moment. So loads happening. As well as the National End of Life Strategy, there are things happening in the charitable sector. The National Council for Palliative Care is the forum now for most palliative care services. And they've really headed up two big initiatives. Dying Matters, which is the awareness-raising campaign. Now, some of this has been exceptionally helpful. Like, you can get little leaflets and cards, 5 things I'd like to do before I die. Just as conversation starters, really. Ideas about funerals, things like that. Some of the things it's done have been decidedly wacky, like let's all celebrate the Mexican Day of the Dead. And you you pin up skeletons and sort of go on a procession celebrating your ancestors and things like this. So you have to take what you want from it, but perhaps be a bit selective with all that. And it very much encourages local initiatives. And there's a Dying Awareness Week every year now. The other thing, and I think this was picked up by the Daily Mail completely out of context, is the Finding Your 1% campaign, which is aimed at GPs. The idea of that is that your average GP can expect that in any given year, 1% of their patient caseload will die. Okay. And it's not about choosing 1% of patients to die, which is what the Daily Mail sort of suggested, or being paid by the PCT to select 1%. It's about identifying the 1% that are going to die regardless of the Daily Mail or the PCT. And some of those will be sudden deaths, about 15%. But 85% of deaths, they reckon, there is some awareness, and you might reasonably expect. So it's about helping GPs to recognise that 1%, to do the advanced care planning, to start thinking and preparing. And again, there's some good resource out there to help GPs to do that. Another strand that's come out of the NICE guidance and the national strategy is Route to Success. And this was really applying the 6 principles of the national strategy in very different settings and to a huge diversity of groups. So they've taken the strategy, they've looked at lots of different settings, acute hospitals, nursing homes, anywhere you can think, home care. Then they've applied it there. Then they've picked different groups out. There's learning disabilities, there's lesbian, gay, transgender, as anybody you can possibly think of. So that's just a small selection of the Route to Success documents, the whole series of them, and they're all on the internet, applying the principles in different care settings and to different groups. I've had the most to do with the one in hospitals, obviously. The care home one, very usefully flags up some of the difficulties. And if you're in anywhere involved in a care home, I'd advise you to look at it. Problems because of the private sector. The owners of care homes are under no obligation at present to buy in to anything to do with end-of-life care. You can run a care home and have no interest in it whatsoever. You can get special funding if you are licensed in a particular way, but it's a complete lottery, and care home providers can say no. High staff turnover, so if you do an education initiative, you probably need to go back in a year's time to redo it all over again. Training opportunities are limited. E-learning is very difficult. A lot of care home workers are amongst the poorest paid in the community. They're not IT literate. They may not speak English. Many don't have the basic resources, like syringe drivers, and out-of-hours support from GPs is sometimes a bit hit and miss. So a huge amount of work to do in care homes. Hospitals, the Route to Success in hospitals has specified 5 ways to try and move forward. Advanced planning and livable care pathway I've talked about. Electronic care registers is a way of all the services in an area talking to each other. Now, I don't know what it's like where you work, but in my patch, the hospital's got one system, the hospice has got another, and general practice have got two or three between them across the county. Some places manage to make care registers work. We're failing miserably. There's just too much diversity. Rapid discharge pathway, again, great, except you've got to have the community on board. And if it takes 5 days to order and have delivered a hospital bed because of the agency in the community that delivers beds, you're not going to get somebody home on a rapid care discharge. What I'm going to talk to you a bit about now is AMBER, the AMBER Care Bundle, which at the moment is purely a hospital initiative, okay? And I've got great hopes for AMBER. We applied to be part of the pilot for AMBER, and they took on 20 trusts, and we managed to make the cut. So we've been involved with this for some time now. It's a tool devised at Guy's and St Thomas's Trust, and it's for people who are clinically unstable and who are at risk of dying in the next 1 to 2 months. So it's not necessarily somebody who is palliative care yet. It could be somebody who's acutely unwell where the recovery is uncertain. For example, a young person with bacterial meningitis, and you're in that phase where you really don't know whether they're going to live or whether they're going to die, or someone who's had a huge MI. So not your classic palliative care constituency. But then it also incorporates what one of our consultants calls the grey area. People who you suspect they are dying, and you know they're end of life, but they're not dying yet. And is this an exacerbation of their COPD from which they'll recover? Or is this the chest infection where they'll die? And we all know that most of the chronic medical conditions, COPD, heart failure, are incredibly unpredictable. And there is this grey area. Are we heading for the LCP yet or not? And what it's about is managing uncertainty, improving decision making, and improving communication. And it's actually a very simple tool. They have taken great care not to call it a pathway. And it's a single sheet that goes in the notes with prompts for decision making and communication, and then a sticker that goes in the notes every day to flag up. Have you checked that this patient is still an AMBER patient? Have you communicated with the relatives? Has anything changed? And this is really what it's about. AMBER patients are having full intervention, full medical management. Nothing is stopped, it's full on, but with added symptom control. Now, ideally, everybody should get that. Why should anybody not be given symptom control? But at the same time, you're starting to think, hang on, you're doing the planning and thinking. This might not work out. We need to put things in place. You know, hope for the best, but plan for the worst. What's the escalation plan going to be? If they get worse, do we go for ITU? Do we go for IV antibiotics again? Are the family aware? Is the patient aware that they may actually may die? Get the family on board, start talking to them. Most complaints about end-of-life care in this community boil down to complaints about communication, either no communication or very bad communication. So get them on board, not to make decisions, but so they're in the loop. Start thinking and talking about prognosis. Start talking about uncertainty. That is so important for patients. Doctors don't do it because they don't know how to do it. Really important. Start asking about preferred place of care. Say this were to go badly. Say you didn't get better. Where would you like to be? So I've got great hopes for AMBER that it will improve things. But at the same time, I think we need to be very, very realistic about where we are as a society. Because even if we do AMBER really well, and we talk to people and we tie it all up, and we get more people achieving their preferred place of care and more people informed, and we use the LCP better, I think we're basically up against huge spiritual issues within our society. And that is what colours the whole of the end-of-life care environment. I come across quite a lot of consumerism. People think that the problem can be solved by throwing resources at it. It will be better if we buy more, thinking that they have a right to different things that they perhaps don't have, and people having hugely unrealistic expectations. No idea that the NHS can't provide 24-hour around-the-clock cover, for example, in their own home. You know, massive mismatch. And also that people who are seriously ill die. They don't always get better. And some of the worst offenders are actually consultants. I don't know what they think happens to their patients, whether any of them actually had a patient who they've acknowledged has died. But the way some of them go, it's as if no one ever dies. And I think the other thing that's driving a lot is fear. And for as many that engage, a lot of patients, a lot of carers choose to avoid the whole issue. They simply pretend it's not happening. And as a result, the dying in our society are still on the margin, far too much. And I think that's a spiritual problem. It's about people's hearts and it's about their fears. And we can have strategies and we can have frameworks and we can have protocols, but basically it comes down to people's hearts and their souls. And that's what we're up against. Healthcare professionals. I could get very miserable at this point. What I come up against in hospitals, there is a tend to over-specialisation. So people will go in with their bit of expertise. They want to help, so they will do their bit of expertise, whether it's relevant or not, just because it's something they can do. So people get chemotherapy that probably they shouldn't have. People get operations that probably they shouldn't have had. We need doctors that can do the helicopter view. They can take a step back, they can take a step up, and they can look at the big thing. Now, I'm in a fairly fortunate position because in my role, I can do that to some extent. But we need people who are not afraid to step back and say, actually, my expertise is not appropriate for this patient at this time, and to have the humility to own up to that. Lots of lack of confidence and defensiveness when it comes to dying. Communication skills, not as good as they could be, but very heartening to see what's going on in some medical schools. We've got a group of Cambridge students with us at the moment, and they are so much better and taught so much better than we were. So I think there's hope there. It's been acknowledged. It's getting into the medical school curricula. Lots of misconceptions about ethical issues, largely because they are so complex now and they haven't been taught. The education hasn't kept up with that. And continuity of care in hospitals means that it is very difficult for any one healthcare professional to be that essential presence, because you can only be a presence for your shift. And, you know, we just don't have the same kind of relationships with patients anymore. The system, peer review, being driven to make appointments, go to meetings, just because somebody says you need to for peer review. Sequin targets, we've had two that have been hugely time consuming and neither of which we were happy to go along with, but we were overridden. And the constant change. Within local policy, within regional policy, national policy. So you feel like that you're on shifting sand. You just get your balance and it all shifts again. But it's work that desperately needs doing. And I think we all need to spur ourselves on and book ourselves into having the courage to keep doing it, really. For discussion, what can we do to really make a change in the area where we are? It's all too easy, isn't it, to sit back and groan that, oh, the system this, the system that. But if we look at our own little bit, is there one thing, perhaps two things, in my own practice, individually within my practice, my organisation, that is a challenge? And if there is, what can I actually do about it? I think we've got to be pragmatic. We've got to be realistic. And it's a bit like the man and the starfish. You must know this story. The little boy walking along and the man throwing starfish into the sea, and the man says, why are you doing that? There's thousands of them. You're not going to make a difference. He says, yeah, but I make a difference to this one and to that one. And I must say, when it's tough and it's demoralising, I think we just need to focus on that person and be there for that person and forget the system stuff, but just keep it on that person.